Hey, do you remember Mannequin? Hello, and welcome to Hey, Do You Remember, a show where we reminisce about a movie or TV series we grew up with, then take off the rose-tinted glasses to see how it holds up today. I'm Chris.
I'm Donna.
And I'm Uncle Moonrise.
And today we're revisiting Mannequin. In this 1987 comedy, Brat Pack heartthrob Andrew McCarthy plays Jonathan Switcher, a young artist who has made a career out of being fired from one menial job after another. His girlfriend Roxy urges him to keep his creative impulses under control and just fall in line, but Jonathan can't shake the feeling that he was meant for more than that. He eventually gets his chance to prove it when he's hired as a window dresser at a struggling department store. His bold displays lead to a surge in popularity, but there's just one catch. Jonathan's not working alone. His partner in crime is Emmy, a mannequin who comes to life when no one else is looking. Donna, what do you remember about Mannequin?
Well, a few things, I guess. I remember the movie being around. Like, I sort of have the feeling that I watched it in bits and pieces pretty young. I feel like it was a pretty popular movie, so people had it, you know, in their VHS players when I was around. Or,
you know, I should have come up with a better name for those, don't you think?
Oh, man.
You would have thought, but no, never did. So yeah, there are like a lot of bits from this movie that I remember. I remember, you know, the mannequin coming to life and wearing a bunch of different outfits. I remember the car getting stuck in between the building.
Yeah.
And he's riding around with a mannequin on his bike. Things like that I remember from my childhood, but I probably didn't see it in its entirety or pay attention to it until, you know, maybe 5 years after it was already out.
Mm-hmm.
At which point I was probably just paying attention to the slumber party I was at. I do have a weird big piece of Donna trivia for this movie.
Oh, good.
And I don't know. I think I just have to share it right away. So,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah. Okay.
So I once took one of the actors who's in Mannequin came to my community college, and I took acting seminars with one of the actors for like a whole semester. So, and I forgot about it until we watched this. And I was like, oh yeah, that's why I watched Mannequin again, because of this.
Which actor?
Do you want to guess or no?
Well, it's definitely not James Spader.
No, not Spades.
Was it BJ? BJ Wirt?
Steve Vinovich?
The rival.
Yeah, it was Steve Vinovich. Mm-hmm.
Wait, is he BJ?
Yes, he's BJ Wirt.
Oh my God. Oh shit. Hooray.
I was honestly going to guess between Roxy and BJ.
Yeah. BJ, yeah, turns out, is from Peoria, Illinois, and he spent a semester. I want to say that he actually performed a role in a play that my school was putting on that semester.
Mannequin.
But I was not in the play, but he did come to our acting classes a lot and do, like, scenes and stuff, and he was a way cool guy. So
he was Emmy in the stage version. This is the way it should have been.
Yeah, we just basically did Mannequin again and again, but he was always Emmy.
Mm-hmm. Carlos, what about you?
I remember this is going to maybe sound weird. I remember the late 80s-ness of this movie more than anything. Like, even as a kid, we're just remembering, like, the way it felt and it being, like, very aware that this movie could only be released now. Like, you know, like, you know, I probably saw it, maybe like six, when I was like six or seven, I'm sure I was when I first like interacted with it. So it was, by that point, it was probably 4 years old or something like that. but I definitely remember that just being like, wow, that's not reflective of real life society in any way, shape, or form. And those are the words that I use because I was very advanced.
Yeah, you're very articulate, toddler.
So
yeah.
Smart.
I remember that, and I remember feeling really attracted to the mannequin. Like when
not
she was
Kim Cattrall, but just the mannequin?
No. Kim Cattrall.
This almost got really interesting, but okay.
Yeah, no. I remember being really attracted to Kim Cattrall as a little boy.
Yeah.
But not knowing who that was or whatever. And when I rediscovered, 15 years later that it was Kim Cattrall, like, oh, really? Interesting. I remember being like a totally different person in my head. It's like this and maybe like Weekend at Bernie's, like movies like that, that just kind of felt very Reagan era.
The McCarthy
America.
Factor.
Yeah.
The Andrew McCarthy factor.
The McCarthy factor.
Yeah, exactly. That has a lot to do with it for sure.
Yeah. Well, I know what you're saying about, I was also, when I realized it was Kim Cattrall in this movie, same thing. Like, oh, that movie from my childhood? Oh, weird. Same thing with Porky's, which was not a movie from my childhood because I didn't have crazy parents. But, like, that same thing. Like, oh, Kim Cattrall's in Porky's. That's so weird. I never made that connection. This was another movie that we had on VHS that my sister and I watched all the time. And like Harry and the Hendersons, it was recorded off of cable. And so the first few minutes were missing. So like, when something comes on and you're like, grab a tape. And inevitably you just kind of lose the opening moments of it there. But so I think this is maybe the second or third time I've seen the very beginning of the movie. And I think this might be the first time I've ever seen the pre-credits sequence in Egypt and the opening titles. And I eventually taped over Mannequin with Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country. I don't regret it. That also has Kim Cattrall in it. So I don't know. Not a total loss. There are three main things I remember about this movie. The first is that the Chicago Tribune had its own version of a TV guide called TV Week or something like that.
Oh, yeah.
And in the back, it had, the list of all the movies on cable that week and all the summaries and how many stars they gave it. And I was flipping through it and saw one week, it had the little blurb for Mannequin. And I saw that they had given it one star. And I was like, well, obviously, this is a misprint. Somebody screwed up here. Like, one star. And, I was a little kid, so I still enjoyed the movie. But I did have this understanding that, well, according to the world, this is not a good film. Because I didn't realize reviews, were sort of a subjective thing. That the star ratings were probably pulled from Michael Wilmington's reviews or whoever was at the Tribune at that time. I just thought, if that's what was printed in TV Week, that was it. That was the end-all, be-all, agreed-upon value of a film. And it's also a situation where I wonder if in retrospect, once the sequel came out 4 years later, I wonder if anybody went, maybe we were too hard on that first one. Like, this is a one-star movie. maybe we should throw Mannequin 1 an extra half star or something. And although for all of its awfulness, there is actually one super important aspect I think the sequel actually handles much, much better. But we'll talk about that in just a little bit, obviously. The second thing I remember is the song, that Starship song. And we can build this shit together. Fucking whatever it is. Academy Award Academy Award nominated. I never knew that until I was looking stuff up. Yeah, and to this day, that's still the Mannequin song. I remember one summer my dad was taking my sister and I to swimming lessons, and that song came on. And I remember sitting in the passenger seat, looking out the window, just getting really emotional, thinking about this movie. Oh, they're so in love, and that was also the swim lesson where the instructor told me to blow bubbles as I swam because that's what Superman did when he flew. And obviously they didn't know who they were talking to because that's when I stopped believing every word this chuckle fuck said. And the third thing I remember, and this is a doozy, and I apologize for the truckload of TMI I'm about to dump all over you guys and our listeners. So I was a little kid There was a great deal of sexuality in this film.
Yes.
And it maybe flies under the radar for most parents because it's titillating, but without being gratuitous. But when you're as young as I was, it's a pretty hot movie. So now I hadn't discovered proper masturbation yet. Nothing was shooting out, you know, but I could do this thing where
oh my God. This,
I want to know kinda, what the end of the sentence is so bad.
Okay, this is hard to explain. I would tuck my junk between my legs and then like cross my legs and then grab my ankles and pull my legs up towards my torso. You had to be lying down to do this. You could sit, but you'd start wobbling back and forth. And so if I squeezed long enough, I'd eventually have a sensation that was 75% identical to what I would later come to know as an orgasm. And the first year I lived in Naperville, the mother of a boy who lived across the street from us would watch my sister and I after school. And one afternoon, I was alone in the living room and a commercial for Mannequin came on. And they showed the scene where she opens up her coat and has lingerie on underneath. And I thought about it and I was like, should I? Do I really wanna? I'm doing it. And so I start giving it, you know, the old twist and squeeze. And of course, this woman walks past the room and stops when she sees me. And I'm thinking, oh God, she's going to tell my mom. She's going to tell her son. He's going to tell everyone at school. But instead, she just goes, doing your daily exercises? And I was like, yeah. And then I realized this is genius. It's deep cover masturbation. I could do this anywhere. And I did. I used to do it at my desk at school. I just leaned forward and press my torso against the edge of the desk so that I could pull my legs up. I remember one time I did this in a Handy Andy hardware store because in the home and bath section, they had a book you could flip through with like pictures of all the different shower designs. And there was a naked woman sitting in one with her legs folded. So you couldn't see anything. But again, that was enough. So I found an empty aisle, sat down and did my daily exercise. And then one time I did it while I was on the couch watching TV with my sister. And she looked over at me and was like, why is your face all red? I wish I could remember like how I discovered I could do this. And I've always been like very curious if like can other guys do this or am I just the least effective member of the X-Men? Like what kind of superpower is this? I don't understand what's happening. So yeah, this film will always be linked with that sexy chapter of my life.
Wow.
I don't have a good segue out of that.
No one does ever. No one will ever have that segue.
No.
So anyways, we just looked at it with fresh eyes. So let's see how Mannequin holds up. So, oh, actually, before I get into the synopsis, I want to point out that on the poster for the movie, the tagline is, "Some guys have all the luck." What the fuck does that mean? What is that? How does that have anything to do with this film?
Yeah, what? That has nothing to do with this film.
You have
some guys
an imaginary girl who just comes to life when you want her to, and she's super hot.
I don't,
you
I mean, I,
son of a gun.
It's like, it kind of sort of pertains to the very last scene where the other guy is trying to get a mannequin to come to life. But like, oh, I'm not as lucky as that other guy. But like, that's a weird way to focus the marketing. Anyway. So, but yeah, so we start in Egypt a really long time ago, right before lunch. A young woman, played by Kim Cattrall, is dressed as a mummy, hiding from her mother who wants her to go through with this arranged marriage. And right away, the movie makes it clear that you're going to have to get on board with a few things here. The first is that the tone of this is intentionally very broad and sitcom-y. Her mom sort of talks like she's from New York or something. It's like a scene out of History of the World Part One, but like without the wit. It's like,
right.
I get what they're going for. I actually really do like the idea that Emmy is a modern woman stuck in ancient times. She wants to do more and be more. And her mother tells her this is a man's world and, you know, she just has to get used to her place in it. So Emmy appeals to the gods to get her out of this. Lightning flashes and she just disappears. And so here's the other thing you're going to have to get on board with this movie. And that is a total lack of explanation. Where did she go? How did she wind up in the body of a mannequin? How do the rules of that work? If you care about any of that stuff, you're going to have a pretty bad time because the movie does not.
Well, how about also the idea that it starts dealing with this, you know, like you were saying, she wants to be more. She doesn't want to live in a man's world, but then she becomes a mannequin.
There's like a lot punishment to get into with the rules for this, and then the fact that, like, because there are no rules, what the implications of this whole scenario wind up being, like, it gets crazy. We do get our first animated credit sequence since Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead.
This was a late 80s thing. Like,
animated sequences
for movies were very much a late 80s thing. That's why I said Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead was like 94, 93?
No, it was 1992.
92. Okay, that's what I originally thought, but I thought that couldn't be. Anyways, 92. That's probably when this started dying. Like, it probably had run its course for about 6 years by that point.
Hmm. So we move to Philadelphia in the present day. Donna, I know you must have been excited that this is the real Andrew McCarthy this time. It's not Schmandrew.
Yeah, I was. Instead of Schmandrew, McCarthy.
You know what this first scene reminded me of? His first scene. It was like watching Matthew Perry audition for the talented Mr. Ripley. Like, he's creepy. He's really creepy in this scene. And I had forgotten a lot of this, too. It's like, and I was confused because so we're watching him assemble this mannequin and I guess he feels some sort of connection to it. And he's like, he's telling his boss, what do you think? I could probably knock out 3 or 4 of these a month. And the boss is like, it's 3 or 4 a day. You're fired. Okay. A few things. 3 or 4 a day also seems like too few. But then for that to be true, I'd have to know what the fuck is actually happening here because all we see is him assembling different pieces. He didn't make the molds. He didn't paint the features. And I get it. There's still something creative about choosing how to combine different elements. But I thought if they were going to go this route, that he'd have had a stronger connection to this particular mannequin. Or quite frankly, this time I found myself wondering why they even have to set it up at all. Like, why can't he just get a job at that department store? I'm not sure what him assembling her really adds to the story. It kind of actually makes the whole thing feel smaller in a weird way. Like, I don't get why this, you know, this series of jobs that he keeps getting fired from. I don't know why that can't just end with him saving the woman that works at the department store, getting a job there, and then starting the story that way. I don't know. I feel like I'm missing something with all this.
I don't feel like Egypt had to be in it either. Like we
could, exactly.
Yeah, like none of it had to be there. Yeah.
Well, especially if there's going to be no follow through or explanation either. I mean, again, this is something that's going to keep coming up. The fact that there are no rules for the mannequin and how she comes alive or what she's doing. There's nothing. There's no rules for that. And because of that, the purpose, these opening moments, it winds up serving no purpose, which is really kind of frustrating. But so we see a series of jobs all going bad, all for the same reason. Jonathan has too much integrity as an artist, and he wants everything he creates to be special and meaningful. I did laugh when he hands the little kid the big balloon, and he goes flying up in the air. I do like that part. Jonathan goes to pick up his girlfriend Roxy from work. He does this on his motorcycle, which is a little embarrassing for her. Her coworkers and her boss kind of snicker about it. What's strange is I think they actually started off with Roxy being a very real character. The movie seemed to deliberately not be taking sides. They were in different places in their lives. She had grown up a little bit faster than he had. And the pressure she was putting on him didn't seem unreasonable. And so I was a little disappointed that later on, Roxy turns into a pretty terrible person just so Jonathan doesn't look like a schmuck for running around with Emmy. Because, I mean, I like where this starts. And I think any creative person or anyone who has dated a creative person can probably appreciate their situation. I don't know.
Yeah, it was a very, I thought their relationship was very strange pretty much from the start. It was like, how did he get this girl? I was asking myself right as she broke up with him.
Well, you know what I kind of thought of is like in High Fidelity, how John Cusack and his girlfriend in that, it seems like they've maybe been together since college or something. And then she grew up and got a career and he's still kind of doing what he did when he was in his 20s. I thought they were kind of going for a similar thing here, that they'd been together since they were much younger. She was growing up and kind of living in the real world and he was sort of like, he wasn't quite there yet. That's how I saw it. But
I mean,
as old as time.
A tale as old as time. I guess maybe if I was paying attention to it when I was younger than I am now, because they both look like such babies to me. I'm like, isn't this the start? Isn't this when you would have started dating because you're both like 18? how do you have a history or what would it have been? Because I guess they just seem so young to me, but they're not altogether that young. I suppose they could have.
Well, they must be out of college if they're.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I don't know. He does throw out a perfectly good ice cream bar on their date. That bothered me.
It's a shame, yeah.
I cried. I cried.
But that is the least of Jonathan's problems, the wasted ice cream bar, because the date with Roxy doesn't end well. He winds up walking home in the rain, of course. This seems so cheesy, but this reminded me this does happen in real life at least once to me. I remember one night I had tickets to go see this band with a girl I was really into, and I couldn't get a hold of her, and we really needed to leave if we were going to make it on time. And eventually she picked up her phone, and she was stoned as fuck in bed with her ex-boyfriend.
What?
And as soon as I hung up and turned around to walk home, it started pouring rain, like just an epic thunderstorm. I was like, are you kidding me? Our hero did not get the girl in the third act of that film, by the way. But so Jonathan passes by the Prince and Company department store, sees his mannequin in the window, runs up to her and tells her she's the first thing he's done that made him feel like a real artist. I found myself thinking that we really needed a clearer definition of what it is exactly that he does, or I'd be fine with him being a creative person who has no outlet yet until he discovers window dressing, as stupid as that sounds. But that would make more sense for the story. But they never make it clear that's what's happening or that's what we're supposed to be taking away from all of this. He says to the mannequin, I wanted to take you home, but they wouldn't let me. Ugh, this feels off. This feels so creepy this time. And here's the thing, though. Apparently, Jonathan was not originally going to be teen beat sensation Andrew McCarthy. Apparently, the original idea was to have someone like Dudley Moore playing an older, sadder version of the character, someone who was a little more awkward and had difficulty relating to people. Oh. And doesn't that make a lot more sense? Like a guy who isn't already dating a super hot woman and isn't quippy and clever and pretty hip?
Seriously, like Rick Moranis.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I was thinking, you know, that's crazy. As I was watching this, I was thinking how Lars and the Real Girl is like a better version of this of this story. That's how. Totally. But yeah, I can see the Dudley Moore version of this. It makes me sad that it doesn't exist. Now, nothing against Andrew McCarthy, but.
Yeah, he's just way too smooth and charming.
And it's like, yeah, and then he's got like two hot girls that he's kind of so the next morning he returns to look at the mannequin and meets the store's manager Claire, played by Estelle Getty. There's the whole business where they're hanging some sign for some 100-year anniversary. There's a mishap, the sign falls, he saves her from it, and as he's swinging around on it, says that, you know, in order to repay him, she can give him a job. I do like that as he swings back and forth, those exposed wires on his butt and balls. So she takes him inside, gives him a tour of the store. She's been in charge for 2 weeks. place is totally empty. And he's like, oh, so when do you open? And she's sort of like, oh, that's kind of the problem. We are open. She introduces him to the vice president, Richards, played by a wonderfully slimy James Spader.
Oh my God.
Considering this is very close to when him and Andrew McCarthy both are in Pretty in Pink, mm-hmm. just the kind of characters, other characters James Spader was playing in the mid to late 80s, you know, this is like, again, I know everybody's a little, you know, broad here, but like he's really good at being slimy. He was really good in this.
Oh, he's great. And all those early 80s movies, I feel like he's so awful in the best possible way. I actually grew up in watching those movies, really having a crush on him more often because I was so fascinated with his bad guy portrayals.
Mm.
And I would always like have a crush on him and hope that he wouldn't really be that mean.
I can change him.
Maybe he's just a really nice person and a good actor is what I would hope. I don't really know anything about him as a person, but he sure can act, right?
Yeah, I mean, just look at something like, you know, think about him as the lead in something like Sex, Lies, and Videotape. And then in this, it's fun to see him just commit to a more cartoonish performance. And like his mannerisms, just the way he moves his torso and his shoulders are very high. I like that he's going for it here. That was fun to watch. He is a guy that I feel like aged 30 years in like overnight. Like I keep seeing commercials for whatever that new show he's on. And just
the
like,
Blacklist.
Even when, when he popped up on The Office, I was like, oh shit, he got old. And then even just between The Office and this other show, it's like, what is happening? Whatever you're doing, stop.
Well, he's aging. I don't know that he can stop aging.
He's getting older. But Secretary, that's sort of where.
Right, but that doesn't even feel like it was that long ago, does it? I guess
no,
it was. But
he still feels sort of young in that.
Yeah, yeah.
I feel like when I see commercials for The Blacklist, I'm like, James Spader, you went into makeup early and got old on purpose. like, I still think that there's like a really skinny, super blonde kid in there being like all affected.
Well,
and
it's just, it's really jarring, especially when you look at, like, Andrew McCarthy doesn't look that different now. I mean, you know, he's older, obviously, but he doesn't look that different.
Yeah, I guess he doesn't.
Guys, Secretary was 12 years ago.
Ugh. Time is a wicked mistress, y'all.
It comes for us all.
Yeah, it does. Claire wants... Blah, 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 blah. Where are we at? Slimy James Spader. Sorry, I'm lost. Little does Claire know that he wants the store to fail so that he can convince the board to sell the place. Claire forces him to give Jonathan a job. Jonathan wants to work with the mannequins because he's a creepy deviant who wants to do his daily exercises. But Richards instead makes him a stock boy. There's a really quick scene of Roxy with her coworker, Armand, who's hitting on her. I kind of love this guy. Like, he's the most cartoony of everybody in this cartoonish cast. But I'm fine with it because everybody's in the same movie here. Like, everyone's playing in the same heightened reality. So even if it's not your cup of tea, you have to recognize that at least it's consistent and intentional. Jonathan sneaks away to visit his mannequin, and this is where we meet Hollywood. This is so awkwardly staged. There's no master shot. Like, Hollywood just appears in close-up. It's just like, wow, what's going on? Where'd he come from? And we should absolutely discuss Hollywood, but before we do, I want to briefly mention the security guard character because I think his introductory scene informs what's happening with Hollywood just a little bit. The guard's name is Felix. He's played by G.W. Bailey, who most people would probably recognize as Captain Harris from the Police Academy movies. Also very broad, but like the others, I think also very memorable, him and his bulldog Rambo. And in his first interaction with Jonathan, he makes a joke about Jonathan possibly being gay. But then, and I thought, oh, okay, it's this kind of movie where that's the punchline. But then Jonathan immediately calls him out for being a bigot. Now, the movie is sending some mixed messages here because The very next scene is Hollywood complaining about his thighs and being very theatrical. But they clearly have an affection for the character, as misguided as the portrayal is. Like, I mean, you can certainly take this to task, and we might, but I don't think you can overlook the fact that the only people who are prejudiced towards him in the film are characters that the movie goes out of way to establish as, you know, the villains. It's kind of similar to the Fisher Stevens thing in the Short Circuit movies. I mean, it's dated, it's embarrassing. You wonder how they couldn't have known better, but it was 30 years ago and they just didn't get it yet. It doesn't excuse it, you know, but they were definitely ignorant of the fact that, oh, this might be hurtful or ill-advised. At least that's how it comes across most of the time.
It's sort of like movies that that were tolerant of black people, but didn't know how to write black people yet.
Yeah.
So they're still cartoonish, even though you're supposed to like them and the people who don't like them are bad.
Yeah.
It's like that. This movie wanted to be tolerant of homosexuality, but didn't know how to write a comic character who was also homosexual without being cartoonish. And I mean, to be fair, everyone in this movie is cartoonish.
That's the other thing, yeah.
He happens to be cartoonishly gay, whereas everyone else is cartoonishly dumb or crazy.
Yeah.
Basically. So yeah, it's not the same as, Cleavon Little's role in Once Bitten, where you know that the movie doesn't feel good about gay people.
Mm-hmm.
This movie, at least, you know that they had the right idea. They didn't know how to execute it yet.
Right. Their heart was in the right place. And it was just sort of like for 1987, it was a step in the right direction. We just still had a really long way to go.
Right.
Yeah.
I did. You know what? I did see something on IMDb that I thought kind of summed up what was going on in this movie, even though it was written either this year or last year, which is the unfortunate part. But check this out. The name of the thread was, "Why can't there be more characters like Hollywood?" And I thought, what? And I opened it, and this is what it says, you guys. This is the whole post. This is what it says. "Sure, some might argue that he is stereotypically gay, ... but a lot of the gays I know are flamers like Hollywood." That's the post.
What?
And it's like, so,
Jesus.
And so it's kind of like the movie in the way that it's like, he thinks he's saying something nice. Like, you know, it's not coming from a place of hate, but it's so misguided and so ignorant that you just kind of go like, oh, you got a long way to go, buddy.
Yeah.
Well, that's what this movie had going for it, was it had to work through every built up stereotype of gay men, and probably gay black men more specifically. And it was not going to be able to do that because there just wasn't enough of a track record of, like, you know, trailblazing movies like that, you know, yet. So, yeah. So, I mean, I mean,
they're like a decade out from that at this point.
I mean, really, I was about to say Denzel Washington in Philadelphia, but he's the straight one. So, no, it's not him. They're a long way out.
I guess they just wanted, if like I was making it today, I would keep Hollywood because he's a delight. Not because he's gay, but because he's a delightful character. And I think I would say something like, "My boyfriend doesn't want to be with me because my glasses are too sassy." I have too much style. Like, he can't handle me.
I kind of think Hollywood's the best thing about this movie.
Yeah, I mean, he's really himself. He says sometimes he just likes to have it. Or cry shamelessly works for him. And I'm like, that's great. Yeah. Maybe we should all just cry shamelessly and feel a little bit better. But I like his expressive nature and I love his style. And I think there could easily be a character at a lot of those same traits, but just sort of written a little bit better, written knowing that character could know where he comes from and know the world he lives in a little bit better instead of just being in, you know, sort of forced, premature, cookie cutter.
Well, I think
this is what gay guys are.
So I think you can make him eccentric and a little crazy and loud and all that without it specifically being in regards to these kinds of stereotypes. Just sort of.
Oh yeah.
Like that's not why he's. Because in this movie, it almost feels like because of this, that's why he kind of behaves like this. Because it's like that old queen stereotype. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Right.
Whereas
right.
I think you could have a loud, eccentric comic relief character who, fine, he's gay, but he's kind of a colorful character for all these other reasons. And I don't know. Right. I am a little. So this Hollywood was definitely not my favorite part of this movie. And I guess I'm interested in how you can feel that way how you reconcile the fact that it's kind of a misguided stereotype and sort of offensive in certain ways, but still have it be like your favorite part of the movie.
I didn't say my favorite. I said the best.
Okay.
I think he's the best part. I think that I just tended to have more fun when this character was on screen than when he wasn't. And I think a lot of that is his name, Meshach Taylor.
Yeah.
The guy. Yeah. Mm-hmm. He was really good in this.
Would you guys feel differently about Hollywood if that actor were gay in real life?
No, I don't think so. No, because and you know what? I can make a comparison. One of my favorite parts of the movie The Fifth Element is Chris Tucker's performance.
Ugh.
And he's, I mean, over the top, cartoonish, stereotypical. He's wearing a dress and, but he's somehow also straight, but not really. He's basically a straight gay man in Fifth Element. He's my favorite, like, part of that movie because it's just like a different tone to the rest of it. It's just like a pop of, you know, energy in a movie that maybe, you know, without it, I would feel more bored with. And I think with this, I think the actor is charismatic is maybe more charismatic than maybe anyone other than Spader in the film. So, but I'm rooting for him. So I think I just enjoyed him more when he's on screen, but it is, you know, it is a stereotype. It's a problematic role, but I enjoyed him in it.
I'm just wondering if, because, like if that adds an extra layer to, you know, the people that are really bothered by it, if that's sort of an extra layer of like insensitivity, the fact that he is a straight guy playing a gay character and maybe not necessarily giving the, you know, the most accurate portrayal of it. Or if like, I think what you were saying when we did Once Bitten and Clavon Little's character about like, or if just the fact that there's this character is a character like this is being acknowledged in film at all, if maybe that is kind of, counts for something too. I mean, I have nothing against the actor. I have a really, for me, it was the most problematic aspect of the film of like, in terms of my enjoyment of it, of saying like, oh, this is something I'm still nostalgic for and I'm still kind of into, but boy, I really now is like, you know, all these years later, this is a little, this part of it feels very different. I'm not really sure how I feel about a lot of this. I think where it gets too difficult to take the movie to task too severely is, like I said earlier, about the fact that clearly in the eyes of the filmmakers, he was a good character. They were, you know, he's like,
right.
There was an affection for him. So that's sort of how they just barely kind of coast by for me.
I think it's very similar to the way we people have to look at race relations when you watch older movies.
Yeah.
You know, like you can still enjoy an older movie, like a movie made in the 50s. It can still be great and still be a classic even, but you have to say like, you know, for the most part, like whatever so-and-so black actor who might be a very good actor is playing a role that is very problematic, but you can still enjoy that actor and you can still enjoy that, you know, mm-hmm. what they bring to that performance because they're still acting. It's definitely conflicted.
Well, you know what? It reminds me a little of those early James Bond movies, like the Connery ones in particular, are so wildly sexist. And to the point where something like Goldfinger, you watch it now and you kind of go like, holy shit, wait, what? Is this the same movie I saw when I was a kid? And to the point where even though I'm still a James Bond fan and there are things about those early movies I really, really love, like if my wife had never seen a James Bond movie before, I would be really embarrassed to show her some of the early ones to kind of be like, even as much as you go like, it was a different time and trust me, they've evolved past this. You still just, it's still a little bit like, it's just different now. But yeah, you're right. You got to place it in context and all that. But it doesn't, for me, it doesn't change the fact that there are moments where it still just feels a little awkward to watch.
And actually, that is reminding me of like Scott Conn in Varsity Blues. When we watched Varsity Blues, and I was like, oh, this character is much rapier than I remember from being a kid. You know, I'm just more aware of it now. But Scott Conn is amazing in that role. He's really great as Tweeter.
It's just a shitty, terribly written.
He's playing a character that you're supposed to be rooting for, right? But he's a horrible person.
Yeah.
And I don't know that the writers even really realize that he's a horrible person. We do now, but he's great in it. I love Scott Conn in that movie. I just don't like the character so much.
Well, I'm not trying to be confrontational about any of this. I just thought
Jeez, Chris.
I think it's an interesting conversation, and I like that we had such different reactions to this aspect of the movie. I think that's all worth getting into. I wasn't challenging anybody to say like, how dare you like this? I'm just very curious because I just took it.
I think people can be, you know, we can have conflicting opinions about like the same one thing. For instance, I'm not a big fan of football, and a big reason of big reason I'm not a fan of football is that I have a lot of trouble getting past knowing that these people are hurting their brains, right?
Oh.
Like I have a lot of trouble with the brain injuries in football. It's very, makes it difficult for me to watch. But I love boxing, and I can't explain that. You see what I mean? Like it's like I can acknowledge that I have it's a hypocritical viewpoint, but I can't separate myself from it. It's how I feel about it. So I think that all people are probably like that, where we believe something, but there's always, you know, that one, there's going to be like a couple things that are like, you know what? No, that goes against what I said I believe in, but I don't feel any differently about it.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, we've on that note, we have reached a very pivotal point in the film. This is where the mannequin comes alive for the first time with no fanfare, which I kind of like. She's just there. And Jonathan stands up Roxy to goof around with Emmy inside the store. And this magical night ends with her helping him create this incredible display in the window. At least the movie tells me it's incredible.
Right.
So word of this display travels to, is it Illustra or Illustra?
I think it's Illustra.
Illustra. Okay.
That's what I thought.
And that's
Lust.
Yeah, sure. Oh, it's so sexy with all the neon and the mirrors. Yeah, that's the
shopping mall.
The rival department store where Roxy works, and the boss there is Donna's best friend and acting mentor, BJ Wirt is the character's name. I can't remember the
Binovich.
Okay. And you know what in this scene, what I loved that they is in here and that I wish we saw more of is the forceful tie tightening of like another person, you know, like, you listen to me.
Oh.
Not enough of that. Not enough. We used to see a lot more of that. And I think this is also where it's made clear that Richards is sort of, he's working as a spy for BJ. They're in cahoots together so that Illustra can buy out Prince and Company. And at the Prince and Company board meeting, Richards wants to fire Jonathan for this display he's made, this garish display, but Claire and the others decide this might actually be a good thing. Jonathan gets promoted to vigilante. He becomes a superhero. The movie takes a way more interesting turn. He gets promoted to visual merchandising, which is a fancy way of saying you get to play with the mannequins. Richards tells Felix to keep an eye on him, see how he works, see what he's up to. They want some dirt on this guy. Okay, so Emmy comes to life again and mentions that she used to date Christopher Columbus. And then there was this other thing with Michelangelo, but he was more interested in David. So she's just been Forrest Gumping her way through ancient history. But
right.
How and in what form? I kept thinking the reason she was a mannequin and the reason only he could see her would eventually be explained. It fucking never is. And I think crazy concepts like this are fine, but fantasy elements, we still need some context for them. And this is what I was talking about earlier. This is something I think the sequel does better, because in that one, if I'm remembering this correctly, there's a sorcerer curses this princess and puts a necklace on her that turns her – she becomes plastic. And when the necklace comes off, that's when she comes to life. And I think the curse extends in some way beyond that, and the only way to break that curse is to be kissed by a true love, and blah, blah, blah. It's hokey. It's stupid. It's whatever. But it's something, and you understand the rules and what's at stake and what the couple needs to do in order to be together. And here, I started to get really frustrated by all that, because why doesn't he just take her home? Why even risk being caught? And presumably she doesn't want to stay a mannequin. So what's their plan here? Because that's the other part of this that winds up being a little disturbing. Since the movie doesn't offer any explanation for any of this, Emmy comes across as being totally okay with the fact that only Jonathan can see her, and she's happy to just be his and his alone forever and ever. And that doesn't seem to line up with the woman from the first scene who wanted to travel the world and have all these new experiences and all that. And so I can see how in a strange way this is almost like a male power fantasy where she only has eyes for me. No one else will ever look at her as a sexual object, so I don't have to be jealous. She'll come alive long enough to like run around and have fun and have some sex, and then I can just go back to my real life. I'm not saying that's what this guy was thinking when he wrote it. I'm just pointing out that the movie is accidentally making some unusual implications here by not giving them a clearer goal or defining exactly what's taking place here.
That's how I perceived it as a child. I mean, like seriously, as a kid, maybe closer to like puberty, but I definitely remembered it being like, that's amazing. That's the best story ever. This guy has this girl who can only come to life when he's around, who is totally, you know, down to do whatever, and then goes away when he has to go to work. And I remember just being like, that's awesome, because sex is cool. And, you know, because that's about as much experience as I had with the fairer of the species. So you're not alone in perceiving it that way. That's basically how it comes off, which, again, like we both said now, it runs in total conflict with the woman at the beginning of this film who wanted to be more, who didn't want to just get married to any old body and who wanted to see the world and be worldly. She's like, yeah, she's worldly, all right. She's banging one guy at a time through the rest of time.
Yeah.
And also Michelangelo was gay. So.
Yeah, and there's that. It's a shame because the way that she's set up, it's not just that that's a better story for her, but it also it gives her and Jonathan something in common because he's a little lost and he's, you know, he feels like he's meant for more than, you know, the career trajectory that he's supposed to fall into and what everybody else is doing. So they have that sort of they would have had that in common had that been what the story was actually sort of about. But it's not. So, yeah. Well, I think it's amusing that since Hollywood is in both movies and therefore they're clearly taking place in the same world, this is a universe that has two separate explanations for how a woman could turn into a mannequin. It's like in Highlander 2 where they just completely rewrite the mythology. It's just it's so weird. But they did. They had to do something because there was nothing to carry over. I bet when they sat down to start working on the sequel, they're like, oh, okay, so how does this work? What do you mean there's no rules? What do we do here? And so, yeah, they had I feel like they were kind of stuck. But
before you reminded me about the sorcerer thing in the sequel, I was going to say, "Oh, if Hollywood is the one common denominator, they should have just made him an Egyptian god."
There you go.
Who lives in the modern day as a fabulous flamboyant designer of stores and stuff. That's his title,
fabulous,
by the way.
Flamboyant designer of
designer
stores.
Of stores and stuff. And but stuff. Yeah, he could be like their guardian who brought them to this quote unquote better existence where they're basically dead inside most of the time. It's just a horrible storyline. It's so bad.
It is.
Isn't it great? I'm dead all the time unless you see me.
Oh, my God.
But at least I don't have to be married.
Oh, yeah. You really dodged a bullet. So we get a lot of montages of Jonathan and Emmy trying on different costumes and dancing all over the place. And how on earth are they not getting caught? The store isn't that big. To me, it looks like one giant room with then some merchandise surrounding each floor. But all you have to do is stand on the edge of one floor and look around and you see what's going on every other floor.
Yeah. Yes.
Come on, Rambo.
They are hapless.
Roxy's boss gets her to ask Jonathan to lunch, where she offers him a job at her store. I did like the backstory about him setting this place on fire, even though we never saw that. I like the idea that he's just the scourge of shitty jobs all over the city. I thought that was a nice touch. But, you know what? Why don't we hit the brakes here for just a second and take a really quick stroll down to Chris's Fashion Corner. Okay. The thing that really stood out to me, I hope I cannot be the only one that noticed this. What is with the giant shapeless bed sheets that Roxy cloaks herself in for most of this movie? It looks like when Tom Hanks changes back into a kid at the end of Big, spoilers, and he's still wearing his grown-up clothes. Like she's swimming. Yes. In these tops. I don't remember that being a thing in the 80s. She's a giant gray trapezoid with a human head sticking out of it. It's fucking hideous. And she's a really attractive woman too.
I think this was a thing. I mean, between really large shoulder pads and just as much fabric as you could get into one garment, I feel like there was a lot of unnecessary blousing going on in the late 80s.
I don't know if I am not saying this is the case, but maybe I don't know if there's anything that would back this up. But do you guys think that because maybe here we mid to late 80s is when we're seeing a surge of women entering the workforce and women's rights and things being a little more equal or trying to make things more equal? Was there an attempt to maybe be taken more seriously by deliberately not making yourself an object of, to sexualize or anything like that? Do you think maybe that's part of it?
I think there's that element to it. I don't think that's all that it's about, but I do think there is that element that there is something about, women wearing their own version of a power suit. I had a business Barbie.
Oh, seriously?
In about 1987. Yeah. I had a business Barbie who you could turn her Lady Barbie suit inside out And then it was a fancy cocktail dress so she could go out with Ken after a busy day at the office.
So, oh, just like real life.
Yeah, just like everyday life. But there, I do think there was a lot. And I think women always want to look beautiful and always on some level want to look sexually appealing, I guess. But there is a lot about that entering the workforce for the first time that I'm sure you sort of felt like you needed almost a suit of armor to go in and play with the big boys or to be taken seriously.
Mm-hmm.
You certainly don't want anyone noticing that you have boobs, I guess, because that would be a total distraction to business. Yeah, I think there's that element of like concealment maybe or armoring yourself. I mean, she's got a gigantic gold lamé jacket at one point. And yeah, there's like a leather trapezoid, like you said, that she's wearing. It's very, she doesn't look like a girl so much.
It's, yeah, it's just really not flattering. It like all the way up to her neck. And then there's like that ugly black collar sticking out of it and just, and the hair so pulled good. Back super tight. It just, oh. Yeah, I don't know. I'm not really sure what they were going for there.
I think they were just trying to contrast her to Kim Cattrall.
I considered that. I thought, but it's so unnecessary to go that far with it.
True.
Yeah, she's brunette and the other one's blonde.
Done.
Well, yeah. There's that.
It could never be the same person.
Yeah. I don't know if you guys noticed this, but Jonathan is wearing bowling shoes for most of the movie, except in the motorcycle chase later on where it randomly switches between those and white sneakers, depending on which shot we're looking at. obviously shot on different nights. Yeah, I thought that was kind of a strange choice. And then also a lot of skinny ties in this movie.
Mm.
Are those back? Are we doing that again?
Right now?
Yeah. Like the super skinny ties. Are those a thing again?
I mean, if you want, you damn hipster.
Is it? But is that? That's what I was wondering. Is it ironic, though? Are we wearing them ironically or is this sincerely back?
Well,
I don't know.
The thing is that everything starts off ironically and then it becomes the mainstream. So, I mean, you know, it doesn't matter which one it is, if it's nostalgic or for real, because it's for real.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's well put. Mm-hmm.
It's like fanny packs. They came back ironically and then people started wearing them.
But you know what'd be handy? Just a purse right here on my hip. Strap it around myself.
I had a fanny pack when I was a kid.
Who didn't?
Oh.
You were instructed to put your change in.
Yeah.
The sky's the limit with the, well, actually, not so
that's
about,
not true.
That's so much. Even like a can of soda would just weigh it down. It's useless. True. Just banging into your balls.
Then you can't do your daily exercises.
It's a real problem. But it does feel really good as soon as you're done. Just that ice cold can
crazy.
Right there. The last
that.
Thing I want to mention are Hollywood's sunglasses with the crazy shapes around the lenses. Because I had a pair just like these, except they were orange and red, and they came from Pizza Hut, and they were a tie-in with Back to the Future 2, because that's what they wore in the future. So they had this whole line of like futuristic sunglasses inspired by the movie that you could get, at the store. So I had those, and so I used to put those on, and I'd throw on this denim jacket, and I'd put a paper clip around a rubber band, and then put the rubber band around my ear so that the paper clip would dangle like an earring. And I think I mentioned this once before, but I wound up cutting it out of the finished episode. But when I played with my toys as a kid, it always had to be a TV show or a movie, like with opening credits and all that. And the same was true of just playing with my friends. Everything was this ongoing narrative. My best friend and I, we played this thing called The Dark Ages. That was the name of the fictional TV show. And it was a medieval setting where I was like a warrior prince and he was a magic thief and we were reluctant allies. And we had this whole stupid mythology that we created. But anyway, so I put this stupid getup on and I'm riding around on my bike, which I'm pretending is a motorcycle. And in my head, I'm the star of a movie called Cool Kid. I I don't remember what the plot was. I think I was just basically pretty cool was the gist of the story. And that woman who caught me exercising, she had another son who was in high school, and he was outside washing his car one day. And I was riding around in this outfit, and that afternoon I was actually starring in Cool Kid 2. It did well enough that there was a sequel. And I remember riding past him at one point, and he kind of laughed at me, and not in a shitty, oh, what an idiot kind of way, but sort of in like a, oh, look at this kid just being a kid kind of way. And that was almost worse because I was like, oh, no, he does not think I'm cool. And I suddenly felt very, very stupid. And that was the end of the Cool Kid franchise. The audience did not respond enthusiastically to that one. So, all right. So that's that. That's Chris's Fashion Corner. And then so here, let's jump back in the movie here. At one point, Richards screams at Felix, "I'll screw your dog." Is it just me, or does he think about it?
He does.
Right? He's kind of like, I'm not sure Rambo would like that.
It's like, does he know?
So Felix is determined to catch Jonathan doing something wrong. He says to his dog, "Tonight we nail that little fart Blossom." This is the same night that Roxy and Armand sneak into the store and catch Jonathan while he's being confronted by Felix while he's rolling around with the mannequin. He gets into a fight with Felix, and at one point, you know, Felix is punching him and he says, "This is for Rambo." And then he goes, "And this is for my mama."
I heard that too.
What did we miss here? What did he do? Why are you bringing your mom into this? Now I start getting a little confused again, because the next thing that happens after Jonathan knocks Felix out is the hang gliding scene. And there's some kind of strange editing going on here, because we see her and Jonathan playing around on some bikes first, and then she sees the hang glider and gets into it. But then when Jonathan sees her and is running down the stairs to get her, he's acting like he's just been in the fight with Felix, where he's kind of like holding his ribs and is moving a little slower. Something got jumbled around in the editing here. This sequence seemed really strange.
I thought it was really the way that Felix first comes at Jonathan is he punches him in the lower back.
Yeah.
As his back is turned to him.
Kidney shot.
It's like, yeah, that's just the shittiest way to start a fight with somebody.
You could kill somebody.
Shame on you, Felix. Your mother would have taught you better than that, I feel like.
You could do some real damage.
He's not even looking at you. It's awful.
It's actually illegal in boxing.
Yeah, it should be.
Yeah.
There's that awkward scene right after where then Jonathan's pissing blood. I wrote in my notes here, is she going to outlive him, or is there a way to become human 100% of the time? Why isn't this a priority? and the other thing is, in just a scene or two, Richards and Felix get fired and Jonathan gets promoted to vice president. And Emmy starts to kind of like distance herself from him. She starts being weird and saying things like he can't let her stand in the way of his career. What does she know that we don't? Why is this a setback to their relationship? I didn't understand any of that.
Didn't it almost feel like there was another plot line that was just not being addressed?
I think the whole fucking explanation, at some point they just decided nobody's going to care why she's a mannequin. No one's going to care how this works. Just cut it out. And so, you're left with scenes like this where it feels like they're referencing something that we are not privy to.
I mean, they weren't wrong. This movie did very well at box office compared to how much it cost to make it. It was a $6 million movie, and it made $42 million in 1987.
Wow.
I mean, that's not bad.
So, I mean, there's the answer. People didn't care.
People did not care.
Right, yeah.
Okay. Bop. My notes start turning into such nonsense at this point. Okay. Felix says that he can identify Jonathan's mannequin, and then, you know, Elestra can use her to get Jonathan to come work for them. They also have photos of him from when Felix, you know, busted the two of them together. But honestly, those photos don't look that incriminating. It kind of looks like a mannequin display fell on him. It's not like they caught him sticking his dick in it. He's not even, like, in a state of undress.
Different movie.
I don't understand how that would ruin his life.
It wouldn't.
Yeah, and Hollywood doesn't seem to mind him. He's like, not at all. You're just eccentric.
And that's the other thing that I wish they had established a little more clearly is that, like, apparently everyone at the store kind of knows that he's got something going on with this mannequin. But maybe have something in there about let's just let him do what he's got to do, because if that's what allows him to create these amazing windows and that's what's saving the store, hey, means to an end, you know? And then this is where the movie really proves it doesn't give a fuckity fuck about anything, because it shows plain as day that Emmy can leave the store. Her and Jonathan get on his motorcycle and they're chased by Felix and Richards. This is all pretty stupid too, but I like when the car goes up in the air and gets wedged in the alley.
I do too.
I think that's funny. and then I presumably, like, right after that, they go right back to the store. Jonathan and Emmy just fuck all over it, all over the place. Take her home, dude. You had her on the bike already. Just go. Why do they go back to the store? There's no reason for this. He falls asleep there. Richards and Felix grab Emmy. Jonathan wakes up the next morning surrounded by a crowd of customers. How would no one catch him before the store opens? Not a single other employee. He's like setting up their counter for the day and like, oh, someone should wake up the naked guy before we unlock the doors.
Everyone, I love, it's not like the customers just find him. It's like a whole crowd is applauding.
Yes. And applauding what? He's by himself. Hooray. You've definitely slept here by yourself naked.
And his window is destroyed because all the mannequins are gone, so they're not really applauding the window.
And Hollywood tells him they've stolen all of the female mannequins, but the very next thing we see is like female mannequins in the window. except these two. Shut up. Jonathan runs to Elestra to get Emmy back. I do not understand my next note. It says, bad girl, make sure we get it. Did I start watching porn?
Is it about Roxy and making sure that we get that she's not a good person?
I don't know. I'm trying to remember what scene would have. What the hell does that mean?
Well, after that, they had that scene where Roxy finally goes home with the really inappropriate guy, and he has ED.
Oh, yeah. That must be what this is referring to then.
Mm-hmm.
Where Armand can't get it up.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, just make sure we understand she's a real piece of trash and he deserves to be with Emmy. So it's unnecessary. Yeah, okay, that must be what it... I thought, like, transcribing Pornhub videos, that's it. Oh, make sure we get it, baby. Oh. Okay, so Roxy is tired of Jonathan's devotion to this dummy and decides to destroy it. She sends a bunch of them rolling up towards that shredder thing. Jonathan runs up the platform to save Emmy just before she falls in. The fucking guy working in the warehouse there sure takes his time hitting the off switch. I mean, they milk that moment for so long, and then it climaxes with just the guy walking across the room and going, oh, here, I'll just flip this. Where were you, buddy? And then, so as Emmy, the mannequin, is dangling there, she suddenly comes alive, does not look all that concerned about being dropped into this fucking chipper. But now she's not just alive for Jonathan. Now everyone can see her. Why? Who knows? The bad guys get arrested. Jonathan marries Emmy in the window of Prince and Company, and nothing's gonna stop them now. And that's Mannequin.
Nothing's gonna stop us now.
Such a good song.
You know all the words.
That's the best thing about the movie. So,
love us. We'll still have each other. I'll just hang up and keep singing. Go ahead.
Final thoughts on Mannequin, Donna.
What a show, you know?
What a show, you know?
It is pretty silly, and there are no rules for anything. But you kind of can't help but be captivated by the idea that maybe what would it be like if mannequins could come to life for no reason at all, other than they had a bad day in Egypt a really long time ago. it's still really entertaining. I feel like we totally skipped over the sequence where she changes clothes all the time, which is really the benefit of being a mannequin. I mean, if I'm a little girl in the 1980s, do you want to ever be a mannequin? Yeah, because I can wear all of the clothes that there are.
But you don't get to pick them.
Ever. No. But you do if you come alive at night.
But then you're
yourself.
Not a mannequin. You can do that. You can do that right now, Donna.
You're the mannequin. And then you can do it. Mm-hmm. I can't go into a department store right now. I'd be arrested.
And try on clothes?
You can't go to a department store?
I think
arrested.
You're
going to
be happily surprised.
No, all these years. No, I've never been able. They don't have them anymore.
Maybe you can't go into a department store wielding a gun and because you might be arrested. But
well, then I can't go in at all.
You can't do your hang gliding dressed as Johnny Five in a department store anymore, but...
Well, then it's certainly no place for me, sir.
Carlos, dare I ask, final thoughts on Mannequin?
This feels like a Twilight Zone episode where the twist ending is, you know, like, be careful what you wish for. Because you might turn into a mannequin, except that they then turn that into a romantic comedy.
There is a Twilight Zone episode about a woman who is trapped in a department store and doesn't understand why she can't leave.
The twist winds up
being she's a mannequin. It's one of my favorites.
She's in like the lost floor or something, right? Like,
yeah,
it's a great episode.
Yeah.
But it seems like, doesn't it seem like a Twilight Zone episode where you have this woman who doesn't want to get married and, you know, doesn't want to settle down or whatever. And then she wishes that she wasn't, you know, being trapped like that. And then she becomes a mannequin. And then you just see Rod Serling say, be careful what you wish for.
That would even work in the movie if because of that she was somehow cursed for not knowing her place and she has to learn this lesson or something, and then somehow Andrew McCarthy kind of figures out how to break that curse.
Right, because it just seems like that part is haunting. Like, I don't want to be trapped, but I'm going to be a mannequin where I am literally trapped. All the time.
And fine with it. And her disposition is so sunny.
Yeah, this movie doesn't really make a ton of sense.
I would say none. Yeah, probably in the ballpark of none, of no sense.
Very little to no sense. It's a decent idea, you know, the idea of a person or of a mannequin that can come to life. That's a decent idea. There is nothing to support it the entire rest of this movie. So like from the casting down to the writing, there is nothing to support this concept. But the music is great. So that's good. You know, and we did get a sequel, which gave us what, you know, another opportunity to watch Christy Swanson.
So that's true.
Yeah. She's the best thing about the mannequin movie. And she's not in the first one.
Well, thank you guys for sitting through this, number one. I had not watched this movie since, I don't even know, maybe like 11, 12 years old. My memories of it were very different from how a lot of it actually played out. So I'm getting the sense it was kind of painful to sit through. So I apologize. Thanks for being good sports about this one. To me, everything about this movie feels like it was created with that's good enough sort of attitude. Yep. Like, he's an artist. Great. What kind of artist? Who cares? She becomes a mannequin. Cool. How does that happen? Doesn't matter. Like I said earlier, I do like the absurdity of the concept. I think this actually, it's a really fun premise for a romantic comedy. I don't even mind the broad tone of the cartoonish side characters. I'm still sort of charmed by a lot of that. I actually really do like Andrew McCarthy and Kim Cattrall in this. I know one of the issues we had with Once Bitten was that we just weren't into the two leads as characters and we didn't care that much about their relationship. I didn't have, you know, such a big problem with that here. I like Jonathan. I like Emmy. And when you consider how creepy Jonathan probably looks on paper and how one note Emmy is forced to be, that's really no small feat for those actors. This is another one where I would not be upset if they actually got around to doing a remake, because again, it's a fun idea that you could do so much more with. I still like Mannequin in spite of itself. If this were the first time I had watched it, if this had been something one of you guys had suggested and it was new to me, I have to imagine it would not have been nearly as enjoyable. But since this is one that I grew up with, I still sort of have a soft spot for it. It's like peeing in the shower. Like, there are better options, but it's satisfying in its own weird way. That's kind of how I feel about Mannequin. So do you guys, before we wrap things up, should we do two truths, one lie?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Two truths, one lie for Mannequin. I'm going to give you two truths and one lie. Number one. Before Kim Cattrall was cast as Emmy, Andy McDowell nearly had the part. She had a background in modeling, which the filmmakers thought was appropriate for some reason. However, once McCarthy was cast and they realized that the two of them had just appeared together in St. Elmo's Fire, they decided to search for a new female lead. They didn't want to invite those sorts of comparisons. Number two. There has been talk of a remake for many years, and at one point, executives were considering a plot where a man falls in love with a laser hologram instead of with a mannequin. Number three, a Hollywood market researcher helped design this film to appeal to target demographics, what the industry now refers to as a four-quadrant movie, something for everyone. That's how Andrew McCarthy won his role. Although he wasn't a huge star at the time, he tested well with teenage girls, so he was in. And the whole movie was sort of constructed that way. Which one was the lie?
I think the bit about the hologram was the lie.
I'm going to say the last one, that it was constructed
by the Mark. Okay.
McCarthy.
The lie was actually the Andy McDowell one.
Oh. That was my second guess.
Yeah, the hologram thing is real. I get you couldn't even call the movie Mannequin, though.
Mm-mm. No.
Call it hologram. And if hologram you do that lover. Now, it's just going to be a really shitty version of her. So what's the point? And then, yeah, the market research thing, that's absolutely true, is that sort of how it was put together. And that kind of, like, I think it got a lot of flack for that, that it was just sort of a very generically assembled, like, there's just the whole process was sort of starting to really blow up around this time. And a lot of filmmakers were really resistant to that sort of meddling going on.
Mm. Well, it worked.
Yeah, in this case it did. Yeah. Yeah. So that's it for us. If you're a fan of the show, don't forget to rate and review us on iTunes. Subscribe on iTunes if you haven't already. Like our Facebook page to find out what we're looking at next and to share your own memories of these films. Let us know if you have suggestions for other titles we should revisit, and we'll see you next time.